Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of January. This hour of the program, Artificial Intelligence. The revolution is on, says our guest, Stephen Levy. He writes for Wired magazine, and he has the cover story of this issue on the artificial intelligence revolution. Stephen has a very interesting background. I'm tempted to read his whole bio because it's just very witty, but we'll just read parts of it. He began writing about technology, the people who make it, and its effects on all of us in 1981 and has been pursuing this story ever since. He joined Newsweek in 95, where he worked as a senior editor, chief technology correspondent, and writer of a column called The Technologist. He joined Wired magazine in 2008 as a full-time writer, and he has written a number of books. His penultimate so far, he says, book, Crypto, won the Grand Ebook Prize at the 2001 Frankfurt Book Festival. Most recently, he wrote The Perfect Thing, a book about the iPod and its reverberations in the business and cultural world, as well as in your ear. He will spare his playlists, he said, although I'm tempted to ask about them. His stuff has appeared in a wide range of publications, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and Premier, and he's been a contributor to Wired since his inception. He's also written about rock stars. He was a rock critic for a while, and his next book is about Google, a look informed by a two-year, that's a long time, deep dive into the company, which should appear pretty any day now. It says early in 2001. We'll be welcoming phone calls about artificial intelligence, a report from the frontier where biology meets computers in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, you can use that, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. Is the new book out yet?
No. It'll be out in April.
Oh, okay.
I guess I should fix my website when that's coming out there. As it turns out, books don't get done exactly when you want them, but it was pretty close.
Yeah, it's not bad at all. Not bad at all. Can you give me a definition of artificial intelligence? Is it getting robots and all these computers and everything to think like the human beings do, or a step below that, or what exactly is it?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. It sounds like such an innocent question. What is artificial intelligence? But the definition of it is actually controversial, because when it started, it meant one thing, but it basically computers acting like intelligent, being doing something an intelligent human would do. But there's this phenomenon called disappearing AI, in that every time the computer scientists have succeeded in letting the computer do something that seems intelligent, people say, well, that really isn't intelligence anymore. Mm. So they keep moving the ball. Mm-hmm. Some people say that artificial intelligence will come when computers pass something called the Turing test, which is basically tricking human beings, where a computer can trick a human being into thinking that it's human. Basically, I think I use it as saying, if it's something that really smells and feels like the computer is acting intelligently in the way a human would, that's artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And it's really taking off. It's being used in areas that we never thought that it would be used in recently.
Right. Well, what's happening is it has taken off, and it's done it sort of quietly. There's all sorts of ways that we interact with artificially intelligent computers or systems every day in our lives. You know, pretty constantly, and we don't perceive that. So it's an interesting arc, because when the field first started, it had wild ambitions, and everyone thought that we'd have, Robbie the Robot trailing us along within a few years. And, that didn't happen. And then basically people thought that it was a failed revolution, but with more powerful computers and smarter ways to go about it, the revolution has happened.
Mm-hmm. So Robbie the Robot is trailing us now?
No, Robbie the Robot isn't trailing us, but when we use our credit cards and sometimes we get stopped at the counter, it was an artificially intelligent system that made a very canny assessment that maybe that wasn't, us using the credit card there, that, when someone, follows a certain pattern of purchases, the probabilities are high that someone's stolen the credit card. And that's a very smart thing that, the detective might want to be called on to make that assessment.
Right.
But now it's a computer system.
Yeah. And tell me how it's being used. I had no idea how extensively it is being used, and it can create some problems because it's so fast on Wall Street.
Right. Well, that's probably the prime example. And, in our package in Wired, there's a terrific article in there about, Felix Salmon about this financial system there. Every so often something will happen that goes wrong with it. Like last year, I think it was last May, there was this, just sudden drop, and people still haven't figured out what it was. But that's because we've basically turned over the trades to computers. Most of the trades made on Wall Street today are not made by people. They're made by computers doing the trading there. And of course, all the money is being arranged. Who keeps track of where it's stored, that's on computers. We built a system that's so complex that no human could possibly understand it.
Really? Isn't that something? No human can understand what humans have built.
No, and a big point we make in our package, Wired this month, is that even though we have this artificial intelligence, it isn't a human intelligence. We've had success in artificial intelligence that computer scientists have by saying, you know what, we shouldn't emulate humans. We have access to these powerful computers, and we can make them learn in ways where they, complete the tasks, but we have no idea. We could look at the code for years and not really figure out exactly how they did that. It doesn't really make sense because they operate in a different way than our minds work.
Huh. What's with these cars that you don't have to drive?
Well, that's a really interesting thing. There was, the government, the Defense Research Agency had this big contest a few years ago that really galvanized the robotics community to give a prize to the one that best did an autonomous car, a car that drove itself. And the winner of the most interesting challenge was the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, and the guy who built that computer that went over 200 miles of desert terrain without a driver and won the contest. Actually, other ones completed it too. Was hired at Google, and he's built the technology to actually run on roads with people in them. And for the last year, Google's logged over 100,000 miles of cars driving themselves. Now, to follow the law, they have a person sitting behind the wheel, but the person doesn't do anything in case something goes wrong. It's almost like when you're driving, you have a driving instructor next to you,
right,
with a brake on his side of the of the car. They perform that role. As the car drives itself, it does it in traffic. It stops for pedestrians. Sort of catastrophic if the thing hits somebody, but it hasn't. There's been no accidents except one where someone rear-ended one of the cars.
It's hard for me to imagine being able to give up the control we have, but I guess we do that on airlines, right?
Exactly. Yeah, this fly-by-wire is called. Has situations every so often you'll hear about these pilots falling asleep, and the passengers don't even know about it. The airline pilots, for most of their time are in the same position as those Google engineers who sit behind the wheel of Priuses, which are self-driving out there in California. So this is something that happens every time you fly a plane. All the mechanics of the plane, because they're pretty complex things, are taken care of. Of course, the pilots can switch the manual any time they want, but in the case where the plane landed on the Hudson River, it really was a collaboration between the computers and Captain Sullenberg to get that plane down.
Yeah, but I'm sure glad Captain Sullenberg was there.
We all are.
It was quite a story, wasn't it? Would you want to have a car that you didn't drive?
Let me put it this way. In 20 years, that question will seem silly.
Really?
Right. People are pretty confident at Google and in the artificial intelligence community that these cars are going to be much safer than the ones with these flawed flesh and blood things behind the wheel.
My goodness. What are we going to do with all the time we'll have?
Well, Google hopes we'll be surfing the web and clicking on ads.
I bet they did. I bet so. I'm amazed by how artificial intelligence is being used in surgical rooms now in hospitals. That seems to me to be fairly new, but it's just amazing how they're doing heart surgery and all kinds of surgeries. Why?
Right. And it with not only the surgeries, some of it is remote. Manipulation. But the real interesting thing in AI is examining things like MRIs and finding anomalies that humans can't find. There's things that maybe if you do super high-resolution scans, things the human eye won't perceive that a smart program can perceive. So they could do pattern recognition in something and detect an anomaly or a tumor. And do better with eliminating false positives than a really trained doctor or analyst can do.
Mm. Well, you see, that's where I don't quite understand this, so help me along, Stephen. If the human eye can't see it, but the human being created that smart program that can see it, why can't the human eye see it? I mean, how can you make that leap from the human eye to a smart program that can see better?
Well, there are tolerances that the humans can't perceive. There's sounds that are too quiet for us to hear, and there's if you do really sharp pixels, they're too small for humans to see a single pixel. Our eyes just can't see it. But a computer has no such constraints. If you've got a powerful enough computer, they can see that little tiny pixel, or they could detect a pattern and compare it to many, many other patterns and say, no, this is not indicative of a cancer, where, we see, in other cases, this kind of pattern is indicative. Computers can process much more data than people can. This is the whole secret of Google. You can't get a human being to sit there in a room with 4 billion documents and pull the right one out, but a computer can do that because it can work as a single computer with really, in Google's case, over a million computers as part of its network operating as a single entity.
Isn't it? We take it for granted now, but when I stop and think, when you just said that about what Google has done to this profession, to your profession, to all of our lives, it is just incredible.
That's right. Well, that's why I wrote a book about it. But it's indicative of the larger trend there of having computers all work together and taking massive amounts of information and extracting lessons from it. The combination of all that information, just like tons and tons and terabytes and exobytes of it. You use whatever you want, and then having some really smart algorithms, which are sort of rules and recipes to process information and actually make computers learn from that data, turns out to be one of the most powerful sources of artificial intelligence. So going back to Google, one thing that they've done is they've made a lot of progress in translating one language to another just by analyzing millions and millions of documents that have been translated already. They have access, for instance, to all the documents the UN used to translate one thing to another. And then they take the best of those and see which ones work best and improve on that. And so they've managed to create a language translation system where people at Google may not even speak an obscure language, but their computers can translate English or Chinese or whatever you want to that obscure Serbian or whatever language that maybe no one at the company knows how to speak.
Stephen Levy is our guest. He is senior writer at Wired Magazine and author of Artificial Life, a report from where the frontier from from the frontier where biology meets computers. Wired magazine has a huge, huge number of stories on artificial intelligence in the issue that's out right now. The artificial intelligence revolution is on. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And as you heard him say earlier on, he has a book that will be coming out in April, his next book about Google, a look informed by a two-year deep dive into the company. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Robert Reich will be with us, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He's written a new book about, of course, the economy. Chris is our first caller from River Hills. Hi, Chris.
I just wanted to add, for the benefit of beginners, there are three concepts that I think are key here, and I wonder if the guest might define these ideas. The first is algorithmic programming. The second is heuristic. And the third is the notion that a computer can modify itself based on experience without any human intervention. And I recall from decades ago the example of matchboxes and matchsticks, and the computer is playing a game. Actually, you can construct a computer out of a bunch of matchsticks and matchboxes, and the computer learns through experience as it's playing checkers or tic-tac-toe. I'll let you explain this. But anyway, tell me about algorithmic versus heuristic, and if heuristic has ever been actually implemented.
I suspect this caller probably knows more of the technical basis of AI than I do. But in my thinking, I guess the way I'm interpreting this is that originally the founders of AI had this, what I guess we can call the heuristic approach, which would be to try to figure out what rules humans think by and then make computers do those thoughts there. That's my phone screaming out there. then the algorithmic approach would be something which is more based on these rules that determine how the computers could act like computers and, you know, and work in computer programs and learn there. And there was a sort of a disruption in the AI world during the 80s and early 90s when some of the graduate students of some of the founders said, you know, this think like a person thing isn't really working here. We really should let computers be computers and, you know, like learn their way and, you know, they can use the algorithms to teach themselves how to do things and take uses of this masses of information that computers can process. And then they became much more successful in, you know, doing the kinds of things we've been talking about earlier in everything from running the financial system to driving cars to, analyzing documents or MRIs and things like that. So I think that was the difference, and switching from, if I'm getting the intent of the question right, from the heuristic to the algorithmic was the basis of success in getting AI into the mainstream.
You say something early on in your article, which is fairly remarkable. It gives you pause. The computers are in control. We just live in their world.
That's right. That was something said to me by Danny Hillis, who's he was an interesting person to say that, because he was a protege of one of the giants of the original artificial intelligence revolution, Marvin Minsky, and then he went off and built these computers with many, many processors, you know, thousands of processors that became a symbol of the new kind of AI there. And, you know, now he's seen the field flourish. And, you know, he was basically remarking on how we've basically handed over the keys to things like the financial system and other things to artificial intelligence, to smart computers there. We talk about the people get scared and hearing about the cars that drive themselves. But the cars we have now have our AI built in there. The anti-lock braking system is really an artificial intelligence program that determines how much pressure should be put on the brake. It interprets your input by what you put on the pedal to something that might be the smarter way to do it.
Gene in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I'm coming from an educator-parent perspective on this, and you spoke of a lot of things, but patterns is a very key thing for early educators to focus on. Is there a certain country or region, university, that a lot of this development is coming from?
Well, the traditionally there's been a number of great AI labs in the U.S. at MIT, Carnegie Mellon, and Stanford, but certainly we're seeing advances in China and Japan has always been very strong in AI, and I know from my work in the Artificial Life book, there's a number of places in England which are terrific on it, in Belgium. So this really is a global effort, and the big lead the U.S. Once had, like a lot of things, we're not so far ahead of the rest of the world anymore.
Thanks very much for the call, Gene. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest. This is quite interesting. A couple of things. This may seem pretty basic, but isn't it essentially true that a computer won't do anything or learn anything that it hasn't been programmed to learn, or that wasn't anticipated a result? An example of this would be a couple of years back, the computerized stock market controlled by computers, by many people who have their computer programmed to do certain things. And if the computer, the data from the computer senses that the market, that people are selling, it will sell and so forth. And that through certain glitches or just an accumulation of computer systems who were programmed to do that, the market took a terrible dive for no reason at all other than the computers were programmed to do something at a certain time. My second point has to do with
I think the answer actually is actually no. The computers can do things that quite often surprise you. One of the examples that I love, I covered the in 1997 the match between Garry Kasparov and Deep Blue, and this was a big moment for AI. It was once thought the chess was going to be the ultimate test of whether computers could be intelligent. And people, first said, well, a computer, can't beat a 10-year-old. One philosopher, very famously said that. And then a computer program beat him. And then they said, well, we'll never beat a grandmaster. And then that happened. And they said, well, we'll never beat the world chess champion. And here was the greatest computer or the greatest chess player in the world, Garry Kasparov, the greatest one who ever lived, probably, playing a computer. And in the second game, the computer made a move that was so unexpected and so uncomputer-like that Kasparov just totally fell apart, and it affected him the whole match. And he just still to this day doesn't believe that a computer could do that. He said that it was like almost like the hand of God reached in inside the computer and made this very sophisticated, non-intuitive move, a move that couldn't possibly be programmed in. And in another sense, many computers use learning algorithms. There's one very famous and very effective algorithm called the genetic algorithm, which actually evolves behavior like biological evolution there. So we see surprises a lot of times in what these very sophisticated systems can do.
Point number two, Dave.
Point number two had to do with fly-by-wire, which, as far as I know, has actually nothing more to do with the pilot falling asleep and staying on course than it would have before fly-by-wire. Before fly-by-wire, the original aircraft, there was a cable connecting the rudder pedals and the yoke to the ailerons and so forth. And all that the fly-by-wire has done is eliminate that and have essentially a joystick The older pilots found that was a problem for them, because when they would pull back on the yoke or step on the rudder pedal, they wanted some resistance. The aircraft manufacturers have had to build in that resistance, to give them some feedback. But the younger pilots who grew up on computers and games with joysticks have no problem with it at all. But there were autopilots well before fly-by-wire. If you talk to many pilots, which I have, you'll find out that there was plenty of sleeping going on airliners.
Okay, well, I think beyond just something that keeps the plane on course, is my understanding, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the data process there, and what the computer systems that help all these planes do now, you know, just bring in just a lot of information that formerly could only be done by a human there. You know, I haven't spoken to your pilots, but it is a big issue in planes. And you know, there was a terrific article in the Atlantic that discussing the plane that Captain Sullenberger landed there, about the nature of the collaboration and just how much fly-by-wire works. From, you know, an intelligent computer perspective there.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Thanks, Dave, for your call. Suzelle is next from I-94 somewhere. Hi, Suzelle.
Hi. My question has to do with artificial intelligence and the religious urge in human beings. You just talked about the genetic algorithm or the genetic, I'm not sure what you called it.
Genetic
the way
algorithms,
that,
right.
But will artificial intelligence eventually evolve computers into a sense of the transcendent?
Well, that's a great question, and you know, it was something that's been discussed since the early days of artificial intelligence. There's a scientist named Ray Kurzweil who has made some just wonderful inventions, and now he basically goes around talking about what he calls a singularity, which is a point really where computers reach consciousness, and you know, can they and that's called hard AI, hard artificial intelligence, where you know, computers are conscious. And there's an ongoing debate about whether this could happen, if it could, when we could build this, and you know, you have visions of 2001 with Dave, what's going on, and it's an open question. A lot of people, when I did the artificial life book, it became the argument was, well, it happened with us. Why couldn't it happen in silicon? And I don't know the answer to that. I do know that computers are basically in their infancy. There, we're really talking about 60 years, or something. That computers were these giant things that filled a room and were only a fraction as powerful as the phones we carry in our pockets. So who knows where we go from there?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Interesting question, Suzelle. Ed in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I have a friend that worked for the IBM Kingston plant in Kingston, mm-hmm. New York, and she worked behind the Wall of Oz, which was essentially artificial intelligence. And this goes back to in the 70s when they were dealing with artificial intelligence. My experience has always been working for hospitals. And in the old days, dealing with payroll programs, it would take us, three of us that would add up our employee time cards in about 100-person department, and it would take us 2 hours to total the time cards. We had a computer less than like a TI-99 computer, less memory, and but we could, for the mainframe in our hospital, and we can do. I mean, the whole operation would just take us 2 hours to do on the time cards. When we really got computerized, and just before I retired, I was at a board of directors meeting, and they asked me what experiences I had, and I explained where we went from that 2 hours for adding up time cards to we were using 2.2 FTEs of supervision time just to put computer corrections, you know, to have a straight payroll so people weren't getting docked for their time. And it was due to, you know, the computer coming up with a different time every day and docking employees' wages. And this took, you know, for like 2,500 employees over a year period. But anyway, but just yesterday on National Public Radio, a 13-year-old girl using her computer was able to look at the sky and find a quasar in 30 hours. I still think to really mess things up, a computer can really do it much better than a human.
Well, that is a great point. You know, that when they make things so much more efficient, but you know, because you know, at a certain point, we've turned over the learning to them. They learn to do things in a way that we can you know, examine or tweak. Then things go wrong, like that drop in the stock market, and you know, we're at a loss to figure out exactly what happened there. I had an interesting conversation with a man named Stephen Wolfram, is one of our best scientists, and you know, besides being, you know, a wonderful physicist, he's built a terrific program called Mathematica, and you know, another one called Wolfram Alpha, which is almost a mathematical search engine, and it does very complicated mathematical functions, things that used to take, you know, hours and hours and hours to calculate. It does in fractions of a second, and then there's a little thing, because a lot of students do use this for homework. There's a little option you have to say, how did I get this answer when you complicated you calculate a very intricate function or something like that, and it can't show you the way it actually did calculate it because no human could understand it. So they invented a way to fake it, to do it. Well, this is something the humans may be able to understand. This is the way a human might do it. So when they say, how did I get this answer, they don't show you how it actually got the answer because that would be meaningless to you. They show you a way which is sort of dumbed down so a human being could understand it.
Thanks very much for the call, Ed. Let's go to a couple emails here. I was wondering what the guest thinks about the potential of, I don't even know what these are, memristors, state memory registers being used in AI research in hopes of developing a general purpose AI. Research is being done to see if state memory resistors can be made to act similarly to neurons on a hardware level.
Right. Well, you know, what's known as neural network programming is along with genetic algorithms, is another, you know, biologically inspired, let's say, technique to, develop artificial intelligence. And I don't know a whole lot about these memory resistors, but I'm imagining that it's a way to implement that in hardware to make, you know, literally a brain that can learn. So one more promising thing, you know, there's a lot of really amazing stuff going on in the chip factories that implement some of these techniques.
Mm-hmm. How are computers used in artificial intelligence? It's something we all take for granted now, but when you go to Amazon or you go to Netflix and they say, if you like this, mm-hmm. then you're going to like this. How, out of all the books and all the movies there are, how does artificial intelligence play into that?
Well, there's a number of techniques they use. One is called collaborative filtering. And again, it's a way to use massive amounts of information and take some rules and boil it down to useful something useful to people there in terms of your recommendations. They might see the pattern of what you buy and compare it to the pattern of a number of people who's bought similar things and have a similar pattern there, and you know, in essence, creating a number of twins for you, doppelgangers, who like what you like. And when one of those people buys something, you know, something else that you haven't bought yet. They say, this person likes everything else that, this other person who, she's never met likes, but let's recommend this to her because, her twin likes it too.
Mitrick is next in Fontana. Hi, Mitrick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I have a question about the way that states are using data mining to manage surveillance information as we kind of move towards becoming an information and surveillance police state in the United States. Well, actually, we are one. We're not moving towards it. And I'm wondering, is data mining using AI type of technology? And then is there any countervailing kind of technology for individuals to use to frustrate the surveillance capabilities of the state?
Certainly, AI techniques are a big part of that kind of data mining you referred to. I remember a few years ago, it became pretty explicit when Admiral Poindexter joined the Defense Research Agency, and he had this idea of total information access, and it was a program that was going to use these techniques and data mine many, many sources of information, and a lot of people have real concerns about that, and certainly there's a lot we don't know about, which is being used ostensibly to protect us, but also with some possibilities that information about us could be used in an unhealthy way, in a way against us there. Right now, in order to frustrate that, I don't know if there's an equivalent system there. You sort of have to go off the grid in order to avoid these systems there. We mentioned credit card fraud earlier. So that's a benign example of those kinds of data mining techniques, which can work to our benefit. But and presumably the counterterrorism techniques that are being used are also used to our benefit. But then there's ways that they may not be used to our benefit, and we have to be vigilant.
And thanks for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Artificial intelligence is what we're discussing this hour of the program with Stephen Levy, senior writer at Wired Magazine, author of Artificial Life, a report from the frontier where biology meets computers. He has spent the last 2 years working on a book about Google, which will be released in April. We also have a ton of emails that have come in, so we'll get to as many of those as we can momentarily. On the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next caller is BJ in Green Bay. Hi, BJ.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hey, there's a couple of special Jeopardy programs coming up with a supercomputer called Big Gene. Is that all AI, and how is that going to work?
Right, that's another IBM project. They've built a computer which is going to actually be a contestant on Jeopardy. They fed it a lot of information, and the trick is to be able to process the questions. That's the artificial intelligence in the program. It isn't just saying, here's all the trivia that you have, and just giving it the entire corpus of Entertainment Weekly, and so it knows all the TV trivia from the 70s. So what they've been able to do is make some advances in one of the important parts of AI is to do what we do all the time, is process language, understand your question and to be able to respond to it properly. The trick in Jeopardy is to understand the puns in the question, and of course to know that you have to answer with a question.
Huh? When is it? It's going to be in January.
No, I think it's maybe in the early spring is my impression there. But they've actually done dummy games of Jeopardy and done pretty well on it.
Here's an email that's come in from Daniel. What are your thoughts on nanotechnology, its role in future artificial intelligence, and its potential to be integrated into the human nervous system?
Well, nanotechnology is the use of the very, very small in that, you know, sometimes even molecular-sized computers are probably part of nanotechnology, or, you know, engineering molecules and things like that. And presumably, since a lot of artificial intelligence involves having many, many computers work as a single computer, you can have very, very many of these tiny, even microscopic computers working together, and you could spread them out. It's one of those cases where science fiction could become reality. In some of these cyberpunk novels, you read about smart dust, and there's actually a place in Berkeley, I think, University of California, that they've been working on a smart dust problem where you could, you know, spread things around, and these things would be sensors to bring information into a larger system there. So that's definitely one thread that we're going to watch as AI develops.
Hmm. Chris, they looked up, due to the wonders of computers, February 14, 15, and 16 is the computer on Jeopardy, in case you want to mark that on your calendar. Wayne in Madison is next. Hi, Wayne.
How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Not bad. I called about the Kasparov computer thing, but just a side thing. You know, these cars that can drive themselves. Mm-hmm. You can go into New York and tell the car to drop you off and meet you later. Let us find a phone parking place.
Well, right now, actually, some cars are shipping now with, you know, that feature that lets you park the car while you just relax and watch the car do a better job than you would in getting into a tight space. So that's one step that we're seeing shipping now in some cars.
Yeah, although finding a parking place in New York, the only way you find a parking place is to buy a car that's parked.
Well, when AI fixes the parking problem in New York, then we'll really know that it's arrived.
Yeah, you know, meet me at such a time. But back to the Kasparov thing, the computer was programmed with live moves ahead. They've got that capability.
Woo.
But they designed this computer to do 15 moves ahead. And there were so many processors on that it could do that within the 3 minutes, and it would come up with the best possible route for, you know, because it was that far ahead, and that's how it came up with such as his Kasparov to try and beat the computer, start doing unorthodox moves because he figured somebody programmed it in.
Mm. Right. Well, from my understanding, and, you know, I've talked to Kasparov about this, what was amazing about that move was that it was counterintuitive. It was something that, if you analyze the moves 10, 15 ahead, it wouldn't be the smart thing to do. It was, you know, something which sort of just, you know, change the tempo of the game. It was something daring, something that that you wouldn't expect a computer to make. That it was almost like a brilliant human creative move that he didn't expect the computer to make. And I think that was, you know, something that, you know, when, you know, a computer comes up with them.
Hmm. Fascinating. Yeah.
But this one was different than out-logicing him. It just brute force. It computed every possible move and evaluated the best ones, and so it didn't have to be smart. It just had to be fast.
Well, I mean, when you say it didn't have to be smart, that's the disappearing AI phenomenon. We once thought that in order to play a good chess game, you had to be smart, right? So we keep moving the ball, and everything a computer does, we say, well, that's not really smart, that's not really smart. But interestingly enough, a lot of the things that computers have difficulties doing are things that a four-year-old can do pretty easily, which is, you know, kind of a, you know, maneuver his or her way around the complicated room and yeah, carry on a conversation.
Thank you so much, Wayne, for the call. Our calls have been so fascinating today. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Another email, Stephen. What is the difference between expert systems and artificial intelligence? What's the spark that makes the difference? Computers are digital and sequential, whereas humans are analog and parallel. How can computers be programmed to stimulate human processing?
Expert systems was a phenomenon. It was really popular about a decade ago, and it's still being used, where someone with a lot of experience and expertise, obviously, in a task would impart that information to a computer, and then the computer would be able to presumably operate in absentia of that person, and apply that expertise to a problem, whether it's a medical problem or something else. And they have found that this other approach, this algorithmic approach, using massive data and learning rather than painstakingly instructing the computer, turns out to be more effective. So I think expert systems are on the wane, as opposed to just feeding the computer massive amounts of data, not necessarily from a single expert or group of experts, and letting the computer become its own expert.
Hmm. Milan in Duluth, hi.
Hi. Could you comment about computer translation of languages? My experience with that is that they've progressed quite a bit, but they still can't handle poetry or style in language. So I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thank you.
Right. I think we referred to that a little earlier, that Google, in particular, and other places, too, have used machine learning to make those advances you referred to there. You've used Google Translate, which is a feature in Google. You could take a passage from any of about, I think it's over 50 languages now, and it'll translate that into another of those 50 languages. It won't be perfect, and for poetry, it's hopeless, really. But sometimes it comes up with a poetry of its own from the mistranslations.
Let's go to Ty in Appleton. Hi, Ty.
Hi. I was just curious. We were talking about how artificial intelligence and computers can process information and memory, but how can they process emotional cues and emotions at that level?
They can definitely process emotional cues, and so there's a lot of work to be done to perceive emotions, where they could use computer vision to determine what people are feeling based on an expression which might register an emotion there. Now, as for emotions inside the computer, we haven't seen any evidence of that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. So what's ahead here? Things seem to be happening so rapidly in this area. Tell us what's on the horizon.
I think what's on the horizon is that we continue to rely on artificially intelligent systems more and more in things that touch our lives. It'll go from driving to customer service to anything financial, and eventually, right now we're seeing iPhone apps that intelligently run your schedule. And you could say there's one iPhone app that you could basically say, hey, what's a good Chinese restaurant not far from where I am now that my friends like? And it'll give you the restaurant and then, of course, make the reservation.
And pretty soon get in the car and it'll drive you there.
That's right. That's right. And I hope it won't eat for you.
No, that would take away all the fun of everything. We also haven't talked about company applications for this. Your article talks about diapers.com warehouses and how robots are being used in artificial intelligence to make sense out of what humans would say appears to be complete disorder.
Right. Well, it's amazing. This company, diapers.com, really is an AI company underneath the hood. What they managed to do is more effectively run a warehouse. And again, it's not something where people process the warehouse where this should be at this time. Essentially, they've turned over the organization of the warehouse to a computer system, which figures out the best place to put this, and when an order comes in, what to move around, and the shelves themselves in the warehouse or mobile. So there's a couple of videos you could look at YouTube when you look at this, and there's some executive talking about how the system works. But the most interesting stuff is in the background, where you see these whole shelves of stuff just moving around on their own. There are forklifts like with no one driving them. They're just bustling around. So he's talking, and the robots are just doing all the work in the background and moving this here and moving that there.
What a world. Stephen, thank you so much. It was a fascinating hour.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Stephen Levy, senior writer at Wired Magazine, author of Artificial Life, A Report from the Frontier, Where Biology Meets Computers. It is the cover story and most of the issue of Wired Magazine. And we'll have to talk to him when his book comes out about Google. That would be fascinating, wouldn't it? He said in April. Well, thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production and for all of your calls today. You people know about so many areas that I know nothing about. It's just wonderful. You're so smart. News is coming up. We'll be with you tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network.